You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Well, Blake, here we are, episode 53. It's been about 6 months since we released our last episode. How are you?
Mate, I am so excited for today's guest.
You sound it.
Oh, I genuinely am super excited about today's guest.
Why? Who is it?
Well, it's none other than Ryan Shelton.
Hmm. That's great. Do you reckon he'll turn up at any point? Wow, I wasn't sure. Is that the moment that I come in?
That was the most pregnant pause I've ever heard.
Well, yeah, because I wasn't sure. There was no discussion about like at what point in the conversation do I come in, but here
I just sort of thought you'd know, you'd get the vibe. And
yeah, no, I'm a terrible performer. Got no instincts.
No, I haven't done it much. How are you, Ryan?
I'm good. I'm feeling all right. Very happy to be here. Oh, love the setup.
Great.
The water's delicious. Good temperature.
Yes. Yeah, we researched that heavily.
My preferred water temperature?
Correct. Yep.
You've nailed it. Yeah.
That's a win.
Count us in.
Should we just go for it?
Maybe Ryan can count us in.
Okay, sure. In German?
In German.
Okay. Drei, zwei, eins, go.
Well, here
Do
we
have
are.
A question mark on one? I don't know.
I don't know. It was a question mark. But hey, Ryan, we are so pumped to have you here on the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm great, actually. I'm feeling pretty good at the moment. Yeah, thanks. I'm privileged to be here. I love the space, love the room. Love Elphington. Never really spent much time around here. It's very nice around here.
It is. It's a great little hidden secret.
Yeah, it's very green.
Yeah, super green. Yeah. Super green. Mm. Hey, we on the Doolanders, we just talked to inspiring people, and we've heard about, read about, watched, and seen your story from afar, and we think what you're doing is super inspiring and making a difference to a whole lot of people's lives. We like to always start off with a question which some people answer really well and others,
fuck it up.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to be?
Yeah. So here we go.
The door's open.
Yeah, wow, okay.
Hey, Ryan, who are you and what do you do?
Who fucks this up?
Well, look, you should nail it because we've heard you talk to, the Ben Crows of this world. So knowing the who you are should
in a deep sense.
Yes, that's what we're after.
Who am I? Okay. Yeah, from that point of view I can see how that would be that is a tough question.
Yeah.
I'm going to be
want
one
some
of the ones.
Thinking music. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, anyway.
Okay, who am I? I guess if I was to be really smug about it, I could say like I am a man in the present moment.
Yes. That is perfect. That is perfect.
But that's people will be tuning out if I say that. I'm a comedian, I'm a writer. Performer, I've produced things in television mainly, and done a bit of radio. And now I do a podcast called The Imperfects, and I'm a Jew.
There you go.
Yeah, I felt important. I could just sort of hear my late grandfather going like, and didn't do a bar mitzvah for nothing, mate.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. I think you should add truth teller to that one. But anyway, hey, we were talking a little earlier, and I've listened to a bunch of your stuff over time, and I've heard you describe your childhood household as harmonious. Was that harmonious household full of comedians, thespians, and creative souls, given who you are and what you do today? What was it like?
No. It was no one in my family has ever really been pursued performing or even the arts really in any meaningful way that I know of, at least. I always did school plays when I was younger. Like I played like Scrooge in year two and.
What were the reviews like?
Pretty good. Pretty good now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Hottest ticket in Brighton.
Right.
I there was never really any sense of, I mean, like this was, I'm 40 now, so this was, when I was younger, there was no internet, so there was no, it's a very harmonious house, but also my parents are very practical people. Like they're very much like, find a path that will be, it's like harmonious, but also safe. Like safety is important, consistency was important, and I had all of those, I was very lucky, had all of those things growing up. And but one thing that I certainly am not is a risk taker. And well, I wouldn't describe myself as a risk taker. I think I take more risks these days than I used to. But like I get my non-risk taking, like from my family are very like safe in a good way, in a way that meant that when I went home and I was with them, I felt very protected and looked after and safe, as opposed to so many people that I've since known and spoken to and dated, that was not their experience as a child. And it's really interesting. I think the more I do like the imperfects work, and I mean, even separate to that, I've become obsessed with reading books a bit, like philosophy books or you know, self-help books.
You made ET?
Yeah, Eckhart Tolle. That sort of stuff I've become like super, you know, as I navigate a midlife crisis, that sort of stuff has become like really interesting. I'm being dramatic, but you know, it's the last 5 years I've really like dived into that sort of stuff, and it's which is kind of interesting. I guess I'm jumping around here, but I've often thought recently that, you know, for a couple of years I was on Rove, you know, in like 10, 12 years ago, whenever it was. And I was very interested back then in philosophy subjects, but from very much like a tongue-in-cheek way. Like I wasn't actually interested in the true meaning behind any of the philosophical questions I was making comedy segments about. But clearly there was something in me that was interested in them, because now I want the actual answers, no joking around. Tell me what life's about. So yeah, I went on a tangent and I'm not sure where I started, but
it's all right. So you were rolling around Brighton in this harmonious and safe household. When you'd get up, you'd brush your teeth, you'd look into the mirror and see this 15-year-old kid, and that 15-year-old kid said, "Hey, I want to be."
Well, when I apparently my mum says when I was 8, I told her that I wanted to be a comedian. But I don't think I would have really known what that actually meant, except that I would have probably seen people being funny. And I'll be like, oh, I want to be funny. I don't even know if I was funny at that age. I remember like one thing I often did, because being Jewish, every fortnight, my family and then my cousins and aunties and uncles would all go to our grandparents' house for Shabbat dinner on Friday nights. And so all the cousins would sit at the end of the big table. And every time we were there, the game was always like me, I would have to try and make all of them laugh at the same time. Like it had to be, it was like a challenge, and they were trying not to laugh, and I would have to try and make them all laugh, but they'd have to be all laughing at the same time. I don't remember why I did that, and I certainly don't remember thinking, oh, this is going to lead to anything. I genuinely did not think, I didn't think that I would ever make an actual career or job out of it. I didn't have enough self-belief that I thought that I would be one of the very few people in the world that would be able to actually make a living out of being funny or being creative in any way. It just didn't seem realistic. I think probably because there was no internet, and so to get on television seemed impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways it kind of still is. It's sort of like this impossible, it's not impossible obviously, but it seems, you're just growing up and you're a teenager in this house, and there's no real value on the arts in any way in the house. Not that it wasn't a supportive house, but no one in the family was thinking, oh, come on, if you really try hard, you can be on television every week, or you can have your own radio show or whatever. Like that just wasn't on the cards.
Yeah.
It's one of those few industries though that doesn't really have a clear pathway. Yeah. Like if you want to be a doctor, engineer or computer scientist or something, you can at least go down a path of TAFE or uni or something, and you'll get vaguely in that right direction. But
yeah,
there's just navigating that path is...
No, it's not only is it hard to... There's no one path or no obvious path, but at the other end of that path, there's like hardly any job opportunities. Well, back then there was like hardly any job opportunities. Now, obviously, you could do a podcast and that could be something that you could do as a creative outlet. And it may go somewhere, it may not, but at least as a way of expressing yourself, there's so many ways to do that.
Yeah.
That's what's kind of magic about the era we're in now. But back then, really, there wasn't, you know, you had to, even to get a video camera was kind of tricky back then. So
rent one.
Yeah, to rent one, or you hope that your grandparents had one or dad had one or something like that.
And it was on your shoulder and weighed 30 kilos.
Yeah, and it took real commitment to go through the entire process of getting a blank tape, putting the tape in, recording it, and then what do you do with that once you've got the tape? Then do you know how to edit? No. How do you edit videotape in the, like, so hard back then? Which is why I think for the people who really wanted it, the kind of, you know, you hear stories about like the Spielbergs of the world who would put all their money into like these short films on the weekend. And I meet lots of people that, you know, do that now, but with a phone, it's easy.
Yeah. Do you remember, was there a time where you wanted to make the impossible happen, or was it a gradual thing that you said to yourself, I'm running after this thing?
I don't know. Like, I think probably, well, there's sort of a massive turning point, I guess, for me personally, when I was in uni. So I went to school with Hamish Blake and Tim Bartley, who we eventually started and still have a production company called Radio Karate together with Andy Lee as well. But when I was doing advertising at uni, because as my mum insisted, you must have a plan B. So I did advertising at RMIT, and, you know, Hames was doing science commerce or something at Melbourne, and Tim was doing media and Andy was doing commerce, I think. Anyway, we were all at uni. I hadn't met Andy yet, but Hamish met Andy at uni, and then we all kind of started making sketches together, like me, Hamish and Tim had been doing at school. And then eventually we got our own show on Channel 31. We did 6 episodes called Radio Karate, and that was really fun. Like, it was just like we had literally had our own show. It was us just essentially doing other people's work, but claiming it as our own. Like, they were all original sketches, but, you know, you could draw a very straight line to the D-Gen, to Late Show, to Monty Python. Right. You know, we were young. So we did that show, and after that I thought, oh, well, that was fun. Like, that was great. Now I'm going to go overseas and, like, just one-way ticket to Europe and backpack. Which in hindsight is very unlike me. I don't know why I thought that would be a good idea, but that's not something I would do, I would say. But anyway, for whatever reason, I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do the gap year after uni. And then I was supposed to, I had the ticket booked, bags packed, had a going away party with all my with all my friends and everyone like that. And the ticket, the flight was going to be on the Tuesday, and it was like the Friday before, and I was all ready to go. I was like nervous and excited, said goodbye to everyone. I'm pretty sure I actually like had the conversation with my then kind of on and off again girlfriend of like, well, maybe we don't need to stay together. Like, it's, you know, like 21 or whatever I was.
Yeah.
And so that was all in place. So supposed to be going away on the Tuesday, and then on the Friday before, we got a call from Channel 7, from some producers at Channel 7, and they said, we're producing the second season of Big Bite. So Big Bite was like a sketch show that Channel 7 made, and it had like Chris Lilley was in it, Kate McCartney, Andrew O'Keefe, like, you know, a bunch of people who've gone on to do lots of different stuff. And they were doing season 2, but these new producers had taken over the show. And they had seen Radio Karate, our Channel 31 show, and they asked us to come and audition to be part of the show. But the audition was going to be on Thursday. So I kind of had to make a decision. Do I give up the ticket? Do I cancel the ticket to go overseas to stay for like this long shot audition for Channel 7? Like, as if I'm going to get that, but, you know. So, or do I just go away and like commit to the trip and, you know. So I ended up staying and doing the audition, and we all got jobs on this new Channel 7 show. And Hamish and Andy ended up being like the main, because on the Radio Karate Channel 31 show, they did the opening sort of duologue, monologue of the show. And then the rest of it, and then the four of us would film sketches, you know, together. And so the Channel 7 people saw Hamish and Andy and understandably went like, oh, they're pretty good. Let's get them in the cast. And then they got, they hired myself and Tim and then another guy we were working with, Dunk, to be like support cast and writers on the show. And so all of a sudden I was like, holy shit, we're in. Like, we've been hired by the Channel 7. Like, it was wild. I was like, I was only a day a week. I think I got like a day a week writing job. I was getting paid like whatever it was, $300 a day to write sketches. Insane. I couldn't believe it. And you know, and also like sitting in a writer's room with guys who wrote on Full Frontal and Fast Forward. Yeah, and
wow, amazing.
Like, it was incredible.
Was it daunting? Like, were you, like, you know, shit, you, the whole term of imposter syndrome now is bandied around all over the place. Yeah. But
I guess so. But I mean, it was pretty funny. On the first day, it's kind of adorable looking back on it now, but on the very first day, because I naturally would just think of ideas for sketches just because I was, that's what I like doing. So on the first day, I submitted like 12 sketches to the head writer, which is madness. Like, that's so many sketches. And he was like, that's a lot. And then of course I realized like day two, I don't have anything.
Nothing left.
I should have spaced them out a little bit more. But yeah, I don't think I was daunted. I think I was just extremely naive. I think I was just like, nothing to lose. Yes, I don't necessarily feel I deserve to be here, but I didn't feel like Hames and Andy were in the cast. And 6 weeks after we were hired, the show wasn't called Big Bite anymore. It was called Hamish and Andy. So as you can imagine, that went down really well with the rest of the cast. but for Hames and Andy, they were like front and center. Yeah. We were 23 at the time or whatever we were. We'd done 6 episodes of a Channel 31 thing. They'd done a bit of radio together and a live show. But really, we're not prepared and we didn't really have any control over the show itself. It wasn't our show. But to all the viewers, it would seem like this is Hamish and Andy's show. But it wasn't. So that was a... Anyway, the show lasted 5 episodes and got cancelled, just didn't rate. And unfortunately, just Hames and Andy got just bad reviews and comments and just got kind of torn apart. And so that was really tough for them. But for me, I was just in the background just having a great time. And when the show got cancelled, I didn't ever bank on that happening anyway. So it just felt like this cool experience. That
Did it worry you at all being in the background? Had you planned on being in the background or you... didn't bother you either way?
Oh, definitely. Because I auditioned in the same way that Hames and Andy did. So I would have loved to have been chosen as part of the core cast. So there definitely would have been like pangs of like, I would have been a bit sad about that and a bit like jealous of Hames and Andy. And I definitely would have been thinking, oh, I wish I was part of that group. But even still, I still really enjoyed the writing aspect of it. And I think actually, even though I would have liked to have been chosen, I remember feeling like kind of comfortable in the background. Like I didn't have to take, you know, me not being a risk taker. I didn't have to, there's no show burden on my shoulders. It was like, if the show works, great for me. If it doesn't, no skin off my nose.
Yeah.
So I think I felt safe in that way. Yeah.
So you've arrived, right? Like you've arrived into the industry. You've experienced, you know, what it's like for a moment in time, and the show doesn't get up. And
yeah,
what did you pursue from there? Like, what where did you want to take your career? And
well, I just thought like, oh well, the show's over. We'll keep working together, and luckily, even though the show didn't work, Channel 7 obviously saw enough in Hames and Andy, and then by default us who were connected to them, that they then offered us a development contract to develop a pilot for a show and, you know, paid us a bit of money that we would just go into Channel 7 every day and we could have a few writers and we came up with a pilot. But which is really cool because it meant that we weren't getting paid properly, but we had a job, you know, in Channel 7.
Yeah.
On like level 7, like in the executive floor, because there were just all these offices not being used, like mahogany walled offices. But the really, really cool thing that happened from the Channel 7 show is, so like I said, Chris Lilly was on that show, and he was sort of his own island on that show. Like, he kind of just did his own thing. Like, he did like Mr. G and did a few other characters like Extreme Darren and stuff like that. And he really just did his own thing. Everyone else was like this collaborative thing, but he was like, I'm just going to do my stuff. And I really loved the work he was doing. And so I said, but he was also very like, he's not necessarily promoting the fact that he's open to other people's ideas. Like, he's not asking for help, because he's just doing it all himself. But for whatever reason, I felt like I got like enough courage to be able to like talk to him and say, I've written down a few ideas of things that you could do, Mr. G ideas, but I've take them or leave them, they're probably shit. And just gave them to him, and he was like, oh, thanks. And I can't remember if we used them or not, but we spoke a few times whenever he was in the office, and he's the loveliest guy and I'm still friends with him. But when that show ended, he had since then got a his own show or development at the ABC to develop his own TV show based on the characters he'd done or new characters. And then one day he was going to the taping of a sketch show that existed back then called Eagle and Evans, which was like these two guys called Eagle and Evans that did a sketch show on the ABC, and they were doing a live taping with a studio audience, and he got invited and he asked me if I wanted to go with him. And I was like, oh, cool. I was pretty pumped like to be invited by him to go to this TV taping. I felt really like in the inside circle. And while we were there, he goes, oh, I'm working on this show at the ABC, and I was just wondering if you'd be interested in like maybe talking about helping me write it. I was like, this is insane. This is mad. Because in my mind, I thought like, well, you're one of the funniest, coolest Australian talents that there is in comedy right now. And you're choosing, out of anyone you could have, you're asking me to come and help you write your thing. And so of course I went and, I met Laura Waters, who was producing his show, and I had a little meeting with them, and at that stage of the show, he had the idea, he knew the characters, but didn't necessarily have names for them yet. He just sort of said to me like, he's like, they were explaining the show. He said, so it's a show about there's a schoolgirl, and then there's a whoever else, there's a guy who has a family, and he's. Anyway, they're all nominated for Australian of the Year. Like, this is, he ran me through all the very vague descriptions of the characters.
He was always going to play all those characters himself?
Well, I didn't know. He just said, this is what the show is. And I was like, oh, cool. And he said, and I'm going to play all the characters. And that's when I was like, oh, wow, this is going to be unbelievable. And then for the next like 6 months, or I don't know how long it went for, I would come in like 1-2 days a week and literally just sit in a room like this in the ABC with whiteboards. And each day we'd do a different character. So it'd be like, Jermaine, what could Jermaine do at a school assembly? And it was a dream, because it was before he'd only done the Channel 7 stuff. So there was no expectations. There was just no pressure. So we could just do anything. And, it wasn't until the Summer Heights High where he'd done this big show and everyone was like, what's Chris's next show going to be? But back then, it was literally just the two of us and Laura sometimes just in a room, just like thinking of ideas for this batshit crazy show that that none of us knew. We didn't even know if it would get up. Didn't even know if it would be good. Didn't know if people would watch it. Yeah, it was a dream. Yeah.
We've actually spoken to a bunch of writers on this podcast. Is writing easy for you? Like, does it come naturally?
It sort of depends what the thing is that I'm writing. Ideas tend to come relatively easy. I love the first part of writing. Like, I love the coming up with the idea, the conceptual phase where you're like, what if this happens with this thing, and you come up with a premise. That comes relatively easy, coming up with ideas for TV shows, ideas for game shows. I feel like I'm always coming up with ideas. The bit that's hard is then the execution of that idea. And that is where it's like kind of almost becomes slog work, because the fun part for me is over. The fun part is the spark of the idea and reveling in like, oh, how cool. And then you could do this and you could do that, you could do that. But then when it comes time to like writing the dialogue or writing the, that's when it's like sort of loses its excitement for me. And I think that's when it becomes harder, because I'm not enjoying it as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How fully formed, because I reckon there's a sliding doors moment for you with Chris Lilly handing him a couple of ideas.
Yeah.
How well formed were those ideas?
Oh, that would have been one-liners probably. That would have been like, you know, because I would have been very conscious not to overstep. Yeah. And I would have been very conscious not to give him anything that, I just inherently knew for whatever reason is that when you're giving ideas to other people for their work, you want to leave them space to add their own element to it. To give someone like Chris or Hames or anyone who creates their own work for themselves, or even if anyone gives me an idea, it's like, it's so important to have some ownership over that idea. So if it's too fully formed, it's like, well, I can't add any of me to this. Like, I'll do it, but it won't feel, I won't feel connected to it. This is just me. And I know Chris would be the same. And I know Hames would be the same as well. I mean, there are lots of performers, obviously, who don't write. But I think if the performer is a writer, there needs to be room in the idea to be able to add your own flair to it.
Yeah.
You found yourself on primetime radio.
Yep.
Ryan, Monty and Whipper.
Yep.
Did you hunt that down? Did you want to get onto radio? How did that all come about?
I think that happened because, so at the time I'd already been on Rove. So I'd done like a year of Rove, I think, or I just started getting on Rove. And over the years I'd done the odd, like, you know, Fox and Triple M and those stations like that. They used to, sometimes they would do development shifts on like Monday night at 10:30 or whatever. They'd grab a few random people together and say, do you guys want to do like a thing for 3 weeks? And then as a way of them trying to find new talent, I guess.
Yeah, so you're One Direction.
So yeah. So well, that's what I did. The show I ended up doing didn't come from that process, but I was sort of in the building. And then I did like a few pilots, because I started to get to know people in the building, because I would go on, like, I knew Hames and Andy, like they were obviously in there and I could get access through them, and through, I knew a few people in there, but I think I just eventually said to, you know, by this stage I had a manager, and so I think I must have said to her, I'd love to do radio, and I'd love to do it with this girl, Monty, who I was friends with, because she really wanted to do radio and I wanted to, and we just wanted a Saturday morning show. Like, that was the sort of dream, and we thought, well, that would be cool if we could just do that. And I think we must have inquired, or my management inquired or something like that. And they gave us a show on Saturday mornings, which is traditionally like the development slot where you do like 2 hours, like 10 till 12 Saturday morning, and you kind of get your flying hours, and then when a slot opens up and you can jump into drive or breakfast or whatever.
So we
did that for a year, and then the following year, the Nova, because we were on Nova, and Nova were looking for a new drive show, and they asked if we wanted to do it, and we said, yeah, we'd love to do it, but we'd also love to do it with this guy, Whipper. Me, Monty and Whipper had already done pilot, like, pitch episodes in at the station, like sort of demo tapes, I guess. And so Whipper at this stage had gone over to Perth, and he was doing breakfast radio on 929 in Perth. And we'd already spoken to him and said, would you want to come and do drive with us if we can do it? And he said yes. And so we asked, and so Nova went down the path of trying to get Whipper over, and it worked. And so we did, found ourselves doing drive on Nova for 2 years, which was exciting. The only strange thing about it was we were on at the exact same time as Hamish and Andy.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So Hamish and Andy did very well on radio. Very successful.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yeah.
But we couldn't, I wasn't not going to do it. And of course, Hamish and Andy would never say don't, they would never say don't do it. But it was just sort of a weird coincidence. Yeah. I mean, I think in hindsight, I can see the strategy from Nova going like, well, we can't, how do we beat Hamish and Andy? Maybe get their friend. Maybe people will be like, oh, well, he's kind of like them. I'm not, but I guess, you know, maybe people will get confused. I don't know. Who knows? That's what we did. Yeah, we did that show. Yeah.
How did that come to a close? Like, did you say I've had enough of this? Or
I definitely said publicly that I've had enough of this, but I got fired.
Really?
Yeah, I got. Well, I mean, I didn't necessarily get fired for any particular reason. I just when the music stopped, there were no chairs left.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, Whipper and Fitzy. Fitzy was in Adelaide at the time, and they brought him over, and I think Fitzy wanted to do a show with Whipper, and or something like that. I can't remember how it happened. Anyway, Fitzy and Whip were going to do a show together. And so that meant that our show was no longer. But then they were like, oh, we still like Monty. So Monty went up and did a show in Sydney, I think, at the time. And there was just no spots left for little old me.
Mm. So what do they do? Like a yearly shake-up of contracts and assess ratings and...
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't think there's any real rhyme or reason to it. You know, sometimes people... stop, like lose their job, they'll have like a 3-year contract and they'll get rid of them after a year and be paid out the full 2 more years for doing nothing. Like that happens all the time.
Mm.
Not me, but that does happen to people. But it was a really tough thing because it was sort of the first time I'd been at that level at least what I perceived as rejection. Like I perceived as like I hadn't been chosen. Of course, I'd like audition for things that I didn't get, but to actually have something taken away from me was tough. But luckily in radio, usually, it's very rare, I would say, not wanting to ruin the illusion too much, but it's very rare that a comedian chooses to walk away from hundreds of thousands of dollars to do a radio show.
Yeah.
So when people say like, oh no, I'm just going to concentrate on my stand up or whatever, it's like, you've probably been fine.
Yeah.
But it happens to the best, you know, the best people have lost their jobs. Like it's not, only now I feel fine about it.
Yeah.
But at the time I felt this like need to have to protect my reputation. So I said, and it was a convenient excuse, like because the following year I was making, our production company, Radio Karate, we made the first Hamish and Andy's gap year. So it made absolute sense to everyone that like, oh, well, that's why he left radio. So they could go to New York and make this TV show together. In hindsight, it turned out being a great thing for me because while I had a lot of fun doing the radio show, it wasn't really my passion. It was like not the thing that I wanted to do more than anything.
So we'll get on to the next part in a second, but there's an underlying tone here of, you know, you've said, you know, risk averse, you wanted consistency, yet from an outsider's perspective, all we hear is you have a job and it's like little contract jobs.
Mm.
Can you explain to our listeners how you actually have some level of comfort that I'm going to have money in the bank account, I'm going to be able to put food on the table because it continues? Like what are those feelings like when you're fired from a radio show and you don't know that Hamish and Andy's gap year is coming?
Well, I did. I did know that was coming at that stage. So that's why it was a kind of soft landing.
Right.
Emotionally but also financially. I was like, well, I've got a job. I can go do that job.
Yeah.
So,
But I imagine there's big peaks and troughs then in that. You've got a stable...
Yeah.
For as long as you're on radio?
Yeah. I mean, at that stage, I'd been pretty consistently employed through, you know, even before I was on Rove, we made a show called Real Stories that I was, you know, me, Hames and Andy were the kind of three lead characters in. So I was never sort of without good work that I enjoyed. And even before I was on Rove, I was a writer on Rove in the writer's room, just writing sketches and stuff. So, you know, I think because of my very, very privileged upbringing, I was never without anything. Like I was, you know, I was very, very lucky in that sense. So, especially when I was in my 20s, I just assumed that everything would be fine. Like right. I didn't have the fear of like, oh no, but what if I go back to what it was? Because worst case scenario, I go live with mum and dad again. And that wasn't a bad thing to me. You know?
So you still felt safe?
Yeah, I still felt safe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I was maybe a little emotionally bruised
by
the radio thing. Like my ego was hurt, but because outwardly no one was the wiser, like it was just a secret that I could keep. So it was fine. And also I knew like when I had like the kind of exit meeting or the interview where they essentially told me that like we're not renewing your contract, I could tell that they were very, because it wasn't a decision that the local Melbourne Nova team, I could tell they didn't want to make the decision, and I could tell it was part of a bigger play. And so I could tell I really liked them, and I could tell they really liked me, and I could tell it wasn't them going like, we don't want you anymore. I could tell I was sort of the victim of like friendly fire, I guess.
Yeah.
So it didn't hurt me as much as it would have if they were like, we just don't think people like what you do. That would be tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said, it ended up being the best thing for me, because I think ironically what could have been a bad situation is if our show became enormous and I did it for 10 years because I was getting paid $1 million a year and could not walk away from it. And then I would have missed out on so much other stuff, which was far more beneficial to me as a professionally, but I think also in the long run, the growth of me as a person, I was much better off for that. Yeah.
So let's just touch on that. We're going to I'd love to talk to you about shortly your meeting with your chance meeting with Hugh Van Kylenberg. But talk about that, the work that you did that helped you grow as a person. Like, I mean, you touched on gap year and heading to New York, but you know, what else over that period of time?
Well, I mean, like as soon as the radio show finished, my Angus Rove was finished by that stage. So I was, the only thing I then had was, well, we're going to go make this Hamish and Andy's gap year show, which I was all in on. Like that was my, I was a producer on that. It was our show. And that was a really exciting, nerve wracking prospect that, you know, similarly, I could contribute to, but I didn't feel like the pressure was on me personally necessarily. So I didn't feel too worried about it in the same way that for Hames and Andy, they finished radio in 2010 as the biggest, this huge amount of hype. It was wild. It was like they're leaving radio to do television. And so, you know, the media were licking their lips like, here we go. You want to do television? Let's, you know, fingers crossed you fail so we can like say we told you so. Stay in your lane. So there's a lot of pressure on them. And it was our, as Radio Karate, it was our first big prime time, like Channel 9's big gamble on us pretty much, or on Hames and Andy really. And yeah, so I was going to that, but at the same time, having radio finished, I was still like dead set on my own personal goals, like wanting to do my own TV show. For the longest time, since I was a teenager, the thing that I've always had in my mind as like the ultimate goal, the thing that would fulfill me and complete my professional life as a person and the identity that I had unconsciously attached to myself, would be to write and star in my own TV show. And I always just felt like, well, that's what I'm heading towards. I never really thought what would I do after that, but I just always thought like, well, the TV show, like that's the thing. Like I want to, you know, my Seinfeld or my The Office or whatever it might be, that was what I was wanting. And particularly having worked with Chris and seeing what he was doing, I was like, oh, that I want that for me. Like I want to do that. Because the amount of autonomy he had and the risks he took, and he was really doing incredible work. And I was very inspired by that as well. So all this was in my head as we were producing Gap Year. And so while we were producing Gap Year, I still had in my head, yeah, we'll do Gap Year, but guys, we can still develop my own shows as well, right? Like we can still like work on, you know, the next, or not the next, the first Ryan Shelton show.
Yeah.
I was like working on that in the background and, you know, trying, and Hames and Andy and Tim were so supportive in like, we'd have meetings and I'd write scripts and we'd read out scripts and they'd give feedback and I'd work on it a bit more. And then as we were working on the Gap Year stuff and it was so much pressure and while we were living in New York and like living the dream.
Yeah. Like absolutely living the dream.
Like looking back on it now, mad, like insane that was the life we had then. We literally flew, it was probably about a dozen or more of us over to live in Brooklyn and film our show that we had pretty much creative control over. But it was so much work because it was so much pressure and we were kind of figuring out the show as we were making it. So it was hard to really enjoy that time as much as we maybe could have. It wasn't until the second season that we did from London that was really enjoyable because we knew what the show was.
Yeah.
We'd proven that we could do it and people were watching and we could actually enjoy the 8 pints that we could have it, you know.
Every night or?
Well, I've never passed out in my clothes so much that I did living in London for those 3 months, yeah. Anyway, so I was constantly trying to like push my shows. I didn't want to get forgotten in the stress and the fast paciness of making the Hamish and the Gap Year shows. And of course, like there's just not a lot of time to meaningfully develop another show while you're making this show that is very stressful. And anyway, I grew resentment and I started getting kind of, I would have periods of being really annoyed that I wasn't being considered and I wasn't being given the opportunities that I felt I deserved, which I now realize is just I was using their inaction as an excuse for me not getting the things that I want. So it's like what I then realized later was that, hang on, I have to do it. It's my thing. If I want something, I have to go and get it and it's no one else's responsibility to make my dreams come true. So, but for that took me a long time to realize. And for a long time, I hid behind, I was able to accept me not having a show because I could say, well, it's not my fault. It's because these guys aren't letting me have it. and that sort of built. And I mean, everything's different now. It's really great. But that was a tough period because I was not able to enjoy that like I really should have. And that's a shame. But yeah.
That is what it is.
It is what it is now.
Yeah.
But as I said before, like kind of part of the person who I am now to have all these realizations, I had to go through all that. Whereas if I had have done radio, a successful radio show trapped in like a, not trapped, but like in a in an FM bubble where you're doing relatively similar stuff every day, I would have maybe started to believe my own hype, like believe the bullshit, not have the opportunity to go down into the depths. And it's all been worth it. It's all been great. Mm. Yeah.
So we'll fast forward. You were sitting in a coffee shop and I'm not sure what you were reading.
I was working, I think.
Where?
Writing whatever show was not
writing the Ryan show or?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay. And you look across to your left or your right and there's Hugh Van Kylenberg.
Well, this guy, I'd never met him before. I didn't know who he was. And I was on my laptop and he said that he just interrupted and said, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm a fan of your work. I like what you do. And I said, thank you so much. And I said, what do you do? And he said, I do these, I do talks. I have an organization called the Resilience Project and I talk to schools and sports clubs and businesses, teaching them like evidence-based strategies to help with their own mental health and help them deal with challenging times in their lives. And And I kind of like really, my ears really pricked up when I heard that, because here I was thinking that I was the impressive one in the conversation, and realized when he said what he was doing, I was like, oh, that's, I was genuinely really interested and excited. And I've always been interested in the mental health area, particularly since, like, I lost a friend of mine who was a writer on Rove, and he was a comedian, he was on radio, and he was a really close friend of mine, and I lost him to suicide, and that was completely out of the blue, and no one saw it coming. He was the joy, he was the light in the room, and he was an amazing person. So when that happened, it really, I just didn't understand. Like, nothing made sense all of a sudden. Mm. It was like, how can that guy do that? Like, how can he be so hopeless or you know, so sad and so, you know, that he has no other options? It didn't make sense. So from that point, I thought, like, oh God, one day I would love to do something that contributed to something that could prevent that from happening in the future to certain people. I didn't really know what it was. I didn't know what I could do. I'm just a guy. But it just sort of always sat in my head, and I always sort of every now and again would think about it. So when this day came and Hugh was telling me what he did, I was like, oh, that's really cool. And he's this lovely guy. He's not the Anthony Robbins type that I would assume would do that sort of stuff. I was like, oh, he's just like a normal, lovely guy. Anyway, so we just chatted like very quickly, and then he sat down right next to me and awkwardly close as we sort of just kept working on our own thing.
So I'm just going to sit here.
Yeah, he is the only table available, and in the cafe we were in, it's called Archie's in Fitzroy, and the tables are so close together that you're basically at the same table. So he sat there, and anyway, and that was sort of it. And I think I got a photo. We got a photo together, and he put the photo on his Instagram. And then I sort of bumped into him a couple of times over the next couple of years, but nothing, you know, didn't become friends or anything. He was just a guy that I met. And then a couple of years later, I was reading a book. I forget what the actual timeline of this is, but I was reading a book. I think it was The Courage to Be Disliked, which is one of my all-time favorite books. Completely changed my life. And I'm not choking up there. That was just me kind of burping. completely changed my life. And the stuff that I was reading in that really got me thinking about my own life. And really I was self-reflecting in a way that I never had before. Because this book was resonating with me so much more than anything I'd ever read. It's like, you know, you pick up a book, it's like the right book at the right time. It was that for me. And I was reading it, and I was at dinner. I went to Dalesford, I think, for the weekend or whatever, with Jam, who is my current girlfriend. And I was like, we were at dinner at this Japanese restaurant, and I was thinking, God, what do I really, if I'm really honest, like, what do I want? Like, 'cause by this stage, this is like 8 years or so of me like coming up with ideas for TV shows for myself, and like trying to get the attention of my colleagues and of like the ABC and of Channel 9, Channel 10, just hoping someone will take notice of me and like choose me and give me my own show so then I can be happy. This is what was in my head.
Yeah.
So I sort of at the Japanese restaurant, I thought, like, I should really, what do I really want out of this? Like, if I'm completely honest and I take away any barriers, what is the very best case scenario that could happen here? Take away all humility, just like everything goes right and your wildest dreams come true. So I thought about it and I thought, okay, well, if I'm really honest with myself, not that I've ever put this into words before, but if I'm really honest with myself, I want to be considered the funniest man in the world. Like,
hey, small goal.
But this was the exercise. So the exercise, like, I didn't expect that would happen.
Loved by all.
Yeah. Completely loved by all, admired, getting emails from my heroes, people telling me you're a genius and there's never been anyone like you. It sounds gross to say, but my deepest egoic desires were
that
this.
Was it.
Yeah. Because that happens to some people. So it's like, I would like to be one of those people. Mm. Not that I thought that would happen, but I was doing this exercise. And I thought, you know, I want to be on like the front page of Variety and Hollywood Reporter. You know, I want to be loved by fans and critics, and I want to be on the stage receiving the Emmy for like the comedy show of the year, you know, best comedy show. Like that, that is really, if I'm honest, that's sort of what I'm heading towards. Like all the motivations that I'm reacting to or being driven by are leading to that. And so I thought, geez, okay, well, let's just say that all happens. Like if it all happens, I should really make sure that that's going to work. That's going to make me happy.
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't, then what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
Like what a waste of time. So I did this sort of like, I've never done this before, but I did like kind of a visualization at the table, and I kind of thought, I really concentrated and I thought, okay, imagine that's all happened. You're getting great messages from people. You're on the stage. You're on stage at the Emmys and you're being handed the statue and you do a speech and everyone's standing ovation. And then you thank everyone and then you walk off stage. So you've done it. You're at the top of the mountain. And I was like, okay, how does that feel? And I shit you not, I genuinely thought, I don't care. Like, wow. I don't feel, I mean, it's cool. Like it would be really cool, but I'm like, I actually don't really care about that. It was the weirdest thing because now it makes sense to me. Now I know why I don't care. But in that moment, I'd done no, other than this book I was reading, I'd done no real research or reading into why anything about the ego. I wasn't aware of Eckhart Tolle yet. I hadn't read any Brené Brown. I didn't know anything. So I still know nothing, but I knew a lot less then. And so I thought, okay, shit, if that's not what I want, then what do I want? What am I doing? Why am I what do I do now? And I was kind of like, I didn't have any answers. For whatever reason, I thought, that guy, Hugh, he'll know. Or I can talk
really?
To him.
Really? That's wow. What you thought?
Yeah, first person wow. I thought of was yeah. Hugh. Okay. Yeah. And I hadn't kept in contact with him, but I thought, I don't know what I thought he'd say, but I just thought he'll at least listen in a non-judgmental way. He'll listen in a way that will, I don't know. And he's a non-biased friend. Like I work with a lot of my friends and I just feel like he's like a third party yeah. person who has no skin in the game. He doesn't care. He's not even in the industry. He's just, so I messaged him on Instagram and said, would you be up for going for a coffee? And he said yes. And so then we caught up for a coffee and I kind of like just told him all this, like just told him what I'm going through. And he was really shocked. He was really surprised. I think that I was like spilling my guts. Like,
I was going to ask, are you a oversharer or is this like just way against your character or?
I'm not like necessarily like a secretive, shy, private person, but I'm also not a big talker. Like yeah. I'm not, yeah.
That takes guts to do that.
Well, I think I felt safe because of what he does.
Right. Yeah. Mm.
And also because he doesn't know anyone that I know.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
he was
yeah.
sort of separate to, he was a separate thing. Yeah. But he was, so he didn't give me any advice, didn't really tell me to do anything, but he spoke to me about a couple of things. He spoke to me about this guy called Ben Crowe, who was his mentor at the time. And that sounded, he sounded really interesting. And he also said, you should read the Andre Agassi book, which I did. And although I don't play tennis, that a lot of bells were ringing when I was reading that book. Brilliant book. And yeah, and that's pretty much all. And then he said, oh, have you ever seen a therapist? Have you ever done like therapy, like talk therapy? And I'd wanted to do it for years, but I'd never bothered to go down the path of like trialing and erroring different people and trying to find the right person. So I just never did it. And so luckily he knew a woman who he said that he would make a recommendation for me to her. And so I started seeing, I went and saw her and still see her, not as regularly now, but still see her. And yeah, so from that, Hugh and I started catching up relatively regularly. It was sort of coming into summer and we would just catch up for coffee and have breakfast and we would just talk. And one thing I said to him, I said, oh, this Ben Crow guy, do you guys know Ben Crow? Ben Crow guy. So he, the way Hugh described Ben to me was, you know, he worked at Nike for years and he worked with like the top athletes and worked with CEOs and like, you know, high level people. And I said, I was like, oh, whoa. I said, well, I said, I don't know. I'm sure he's really busy, but do you reckon he would be up for meeting up with Hamish? Because Hamish doesn't necessarily need to speak to anyone, like he's doing fine. But I know Hamish is a very curious mind. He's like, he loves this sort of stuff. I reckon he'd really love the opportunity to meet Ben if Ben was up for it. And Hugh was like, oh, okay, I can definitely, I'll ask. And so Hugh went and asked Ben, told Ben my story of what I was going through and said that I asked about if he'd be willing to see Hamish. And Ben said, I'd be more than happy to meet up with Hamish. But it sounds like your friend Ryan is actually the one that wants to talk to me. And Hugh was like, oh, well, he didn't ask that, but I'll, you're probably right. I'll ask him. So Hugh said to me, Ben was wondering whether actually you're the one that wants to talk to him. And I was like, well, yeah, but I'm just me. Like I genuinely was like, I'm not important enough. I'm not at that level.
Yeah.
I'm not worthy to meet with someone who has coached Agassi and Ash Barty and all these different, you know, Leighton Hewitt, Kathy Freeman. I'm not at that level. And I certainly can't afford to pay him. So anyway, but Ben was happy to meet me just as for like a free coffee, like 45 minute, like hour at this cafe. And I couldn't believe it. And so I met up with him and it was just amazing. Like he kind of opened my eyes to things that I'd never thought about. The main things being shame and trying to figure out what my shame might be. So he explained what shame is and that everybody has a shame. Your shame being the story that you tell yourself or have been telling yourself your entire life that isn't true, but it's the thing that might have come from something that happened in childhood or a trauma or, you know, your teacher in grade two said that you've got terrible handwriting. So then forever you always tell people, oh, my handwriting's no good because this one teacher said it. Whatever, you know, that's a small version, but like there's bigger versions of that. So he encouraged me to think about that and think about the other thing, which was my purpose and come up with a purpose statement. And a purpose statement, the way he described it, and there's this really good like kind of 5 or 10 minute TED Talk video, which is a guy, which kind of helps you. It's a sort of an introductory thing to kind of help you figure out your purpose, which I can give you the link. It's probably the main thing people ask me to send them is this link to this talk. And so a purpose being, what is the thing that you do that directly helps other people? So it's not necessary. It's nothing to do with what makes you happy or what you, what will get you ahead or get you more money or more power or more influence. But it's like, what is the thing that you do that helps other people? And so that just made me just completely shift the thing that. And so when I thought about that, I thought like, oh well, what do I? What do I do, and how does it help other people? And the sort of what I thought of, this is the bit I didn't tell you about in the first meeting with Hugh. So when Hugh first came up to me, he said, and I asked him what he does, and he explained that, you know, I do these talks, the Resilience Project, and he said, I got to tell you, you know, when I do those talks, I've got to be up, and I've got to be in a good place. I've got to be high energy and feeling positive and bring this sort of positive energy to the space. But often I'll be in a shit spot before I do those talks. Yeah. I'll just be having a bad day or something's gone wrong and I'm just not in this place to be able to do that. So he said, so what I do is I'll go to your Instagram and watch your videos. Wow. And I'll get in a good mood.
Wow.
And then I'll do the talk. So that was like, whoa, that is huge because – and that far outweighs any – Emmy or any like knowing that like me running around a room in a wig singing can like influence this guy to then do this incredible work that is genuinely helping people was huge for me. And so that really helped me figure out, well, my purpose is that I, you know, I guess I can bring joy to people. And whatever that happens from there is great. But like to give people a moment of joy or escapism or whatever it might be is like incredible. And I don't need a TV show to do that. I'm clearly doing it on my Instagram. So that was quite liberating because I thought like, oh, fuck, yeah. I don't need Channel 10 to give me my own show to do that. I can do a YouTube series. It's like it completely changed my whole mindset. Because it stopped being about like ego and it stopped being about me being praised as a genius and started being about me making people happy. So the Ben Crowe meeting was quite transformative. And Hugh and I kept talking, and what came from that as well is like a realization that I had essentially because of Hamish and my friendship from school and how we would both watch Monty Python together and we both wanted the same things. And he got had all this success that I didn't have. And while I was doing fine and doing good things, it was nowhere near what Hamish was. And so I couldn't help but just be incredibly jealous and envious of his success. Not that I said that to him, and I didn't even say it to myself. But in hindsight, looking back, I'm like, oh, I was really... And I think what came from that, and the fact that him and Andy went off and did like had this incredible thing that I wasn't connected to or wasn't a part of, I interpreted that as being not good enough to be part of that success, to that team. So my shame then from that moment on was like, I'm not good enough to get what I want. So it was quite convenient when my shows weren't getting up through that period, because I could kind of go like, well, I'm not good enough, and it's because you know, I could blame other things, but never did I actually say I'm jealous of Hamish, or I mean, not so much Andy, because Andy and I weren't friends at high school, so he was sort of like I didn't have that same, you know,
connection
yeah. I guess. Yeah. So for so many years, when like, you know, Hames is doing the most incredible things that any performer could dream of doing, I was not able to be happy for him. I didn't listen to the radio show barely at all.
Right.
And when they were having these incredible achievements and doing these incredible things, doing this brilliant work, I was not there to congratulate them or celebrate them or anything, because I was just making it all about me. And this resentment grew and it's just sort of horrible. So that's sort of where my shame came from. Only to sort of realize that after meeting Ben Crowe, I was like, oh, and he told me like, read Brené Brown, and I read Brené Brown, and it's all about shame and vulnerability and just incredible stuff. And once I figured all this stuff out about, like I literally got in the car after meeting with Ben Crowe, turned on my voice memo on my phone to just start talking it out. And all this came out like in the car straight off. It was like instant. It was just instant. And I just realized what I'd done, and it was like shameful. I was ashamed of like how I'd behaved, but it also explained so much about why I was sort of holding myself back in many ways. Anyway, I continued to meet up with Hugh and we're having these conversations, and I told Hugh what came of this Ben Crowe meeting, and I told Hugh this shame I was feeling, and Hugh was just like. Like, you know, Hugh loves Hamish and Andy. Like, Hugh, like, loves their podcast and loved the Gap Year shows and their radio show and everything. And so he was just like, what the fuck? You know, this guy, yeah. This guy's having a meltdown in front of me. But it was so cathartic, because he was just listening. You know, he wasn't telling me it was good or bad or anything. He was just listening.
Anyway, you think he ever thought to him, shit, I never should have gone up to that guy.
I know, that's what I got myself into. Yeah. So then he said, when I told him that story about like what I'd realized about my relationship with Haim and all that, all my shame and everything, he messaged me that night and said, you know, we should do a podcast. Like, people need to hear this story. He goes, I would never have thought that you having done all the things that you've done and watched you from afar, would never have thought you were struggling at all. I would have thought you were like the happiest,
yeah,
you know, no problems, yeah, having a great
flying
time. Flying.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't that I was miserable or anything, but it was just like carrying this burden, you know. And so he was like, I just really think it would be beneficial for people to hear not just you tell that story, but lots of people who have their own versions of that, not necessarily shame, but just hearing people whose lives you assume are perfect to reveal that they're not perfect or imperfect. And when he, and because he'd been asked to do podcasts for years and he never did it because he never really felt like anything was the right idea, and I guess he felt like this is it. And immediately, of course, my shame kicks and I'm like, oh, well, you should do the podcast, but I can produce. Like I can, you know, I can help you, but I don't know anything about mental health. I'm not qualified to do this. This is your area, but I'm happy to help and make it great because I think it's a good idea. And he was like, no, you have to be in it. You have to be in it as well. Yeah. He goes, I think it needs to be funny. Hugh is funny. But, you know, because I reckon that both of us could make it like a unique thing. And eventually I pushed back and eventually I was like, okay, I'll do it. And so we started this podcast, myself and Hugh, and then we realized like, oh shit, we don't really know technically how do you put a podcast together? I'm sure we could figure it out. But Hugh's brother Josh is a DOP, he's a camera tech, you know, video production guy. And he hadn't done a podcast, but Hugh was like, Josh will be able to figure it out. And he's an editor, so he can at least edit the episodes. And then the three of us started this podcast together.
You worked out Josh pretty good asking questions.
And then like in the first thing, it was just Hugh and I on air and Josh was, but at the end of every interview, Josh would be like, sorry, do you mind if I ask just one more question? And Hugh was like, yeah, great. And Josh would ask this like out of the park, like incredible question. And the guests would be like, whoa, that is such a good question. And at the start, we took Josh's question out. And like, I think Hugh even like re-asked the question so it sounded like it came from Hugh because Josh wasn't on the show.
Yeah.
Until eventually, I think it was like in the second season, we were like, Josh, let's get a third microphone. Like you got to be on this. Like, you're so good. So now it's the three of us. And we just, we're coming up to the end of the fourth season.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a... It sounds like it's a joy to make.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And like I was listening to the things that you've done in your career, you know, the gap year, the pressure that you felt and writing, like there must be a constant pressure to write. You talked about, you know, you're great at coming up with ideas and then it gets harder when you got to write the detail. From a listener's perspective, the imperfects just seems like you roll on in and it seems like it's all joy.
It actually is.
Mm.
It actually is. Like I mean, Hugh and Josh are just angels of people. Like they're just, I am very lucky to have just like fallen into this situation because they are extremely good, honest, just beautiful people. And it is a joy. It is a joy. It's just like I get to do, and it's not a serious podcast. I mean, it is serious often at times, but I never really, obviously there are times where I have to hold back and not do jokes because we talk about heavy topics, but more often than not, you know, they want it to be fun and funny as well. So the whole idea of us doing this is to make these heavy topics as accessible as possible. We don't want to do like a heavy, I mean, it gets heavy, but we don't want it to be like this big heavy thing. We want these topics to be very approachable and they're the most human, common things in our life. But so many of the things we don't talk about because it's like taboo and it's like embarrassing or for whatever reason, we feel the need to impress people. And so and make a good impression. So we don't tell people our flaws and we don't lead with like these vulnerabilities. But in reality, as Brené Brown has now proven through so much research, is like the thing that connects us more than anything to other people is vulnerability.
Mm.
So showing who you really are is actually the thing. Now proven, that is the thing that connect. Not impressing people, not like listing off your accolades or saying like all the things, but actually like connecting with someone, making that the goal. And we're trying to kind of model that, I guess, and do that ourselves. And the guests that come on are often like incredibly brave to do it.
Yeah.
Because they don't need to. They don't need to like bring this like narrative into their career. But I think more and more people who come on are recognize, like often people will come on, they'll be really nervous to do it, and then they'll do it, and they'll get the most incredible feedback they've ever gotten in their life from people, and then they're addicted. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, this is what it's all about.
Yeah. In 2019, you shared that story about your feeling of jealousy and envy and shame with, I don't know how many listeners you've got, probably about two or three more than the Doolanders, but
it's marginal.
Yeah, marginal. Yeah, got to be a small amount of difference. Like that takes a different level of, it's easier to help people tell their story. And
yeah,
how nervous were you about sharing that?
Oh, 100%. 100% nervous.
Yeah.
I've always steered well clear of sharing anything personal. I mean, even now, like I don't share my personal life on my Instagram. I don't really feel the need to do that. But because I think because in the past, whether it be on when I was on radio or even when I was making TV shows, I just never thought like, well, who cares what I'm doing? Who cares what I did this morning and blah, blah, blah. It's like it's boring. I was much – like my idols are like Sean McAuliffe and Tony Martin and like Andy Kaufman and like just people who have done like these brilliant comedy minds who are pure comedy. Like they don't reveal their personal lives. They're just like jokes and incredible performers. Like – that's what I wanted and still to a certain degree do want to be myself. So because they never did any of that, I was like, well, I don't do that either. And so that was the first time. And I think the reason that I did it was because Hugh encouraged me to do it so much. And I felt like the platform was a safe place to do it.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have done it what I was going to say is I wouldn't have done it when I was on Nova, but I probably would do it on Nova now because I'm in a different place in my life.
Yeah.
But back then I just wasn't in a place to talk about it. I had no idea what was going on. So I think I was so nervous. The main reason I was nervous was that it meant that I had to talk to Hamish about it. That was like the really, because if I didn't do the podcast about it, I would have probably just never spoken to Hames about it and would have it would have helped me. But to have that conversation with him is like painful.
Fuck, that's hard.
It's so scary. But I knew, of course, I had to before I was going to air it on a podcast and had to get his blessing before I even did it. So, yeah, I kept putting it off. And then eventually, it was like at the point where I was like, I have to do it. And so I went out for dinner with Hames and told him all that. And of course, Hames is incredible and still like, you know, one of my bestest, closest friends. But he's also very like you can have a conversation with him like that. Like he's not scared of that conversation. He's not shaking it off or, oh mate, don't worry about it. Like he's not that guy. So he just let me get it all. I just said it all. He let me get it out, and it was really good. But then the main thing I was worried about, the main reason I was worried about doing it as a podcast episode is I was like, I don't want him to have to then deal with any questions from like shitty clickbait websites want to turn it into something it's not. So that was more my concern. Luckily, it didn't. Nothing. You know, no one wrote anything about it. It was, it just existed. But what it did do was, because I had that conversation with him, it was, it it didn't necessarily like change our relationship or anything. We were close anyway. Still, always have been really close. But I think it just removed like a little like weird thing that just was this unspoken weirdness between us that had existed for so long that I think both of us had just like come to terms with the fact that, oh, well, that's that weird time where, you know, Ryan didn't really listen to my radio show and didn't celebrate me and didn't really talk to me about it that much. Because of course he noticed, like he could tell that, you know. So if anything, it's removed that weird part of our story, of our history. Which was just incredible. And once I did that episode, and realized that it wasn't a big deal. It was a big deal, but it wasn't actually a big deal in this grand scheme of life. Like, people do shit like that all the time. But it just meant that, like, that was kind of, then the floodgates were open. Then I was like, oh, there is a good reason to do this. It's not like I don't think I'd necessarily tell a story if I didn't feel like it could help. It could help people deal with the stuff that they're thinking about or dealing with or scared to confront. I mean, I'm one of like a million. There's so many people doing this sort of stuff, but it feels good to do it.
Has it changed? Like, you know, it is interesting sitting from, you know, this viewpoint, having no idea, like this is the first time we've met, having no idea who you are and what goes on between your ears. But listening to The Imperfects and listening to you tell your story and listening to actually some of the latest episodes on what you've been away for 3 months and how much of being that open and that vulnerable changed who you are? How much has it changed who you are and your level of happiness with who you are?
Oh, it's changed everything. Right. It's changed everything. Like, down to the way I communicate with my family, girlfriend, everything. Yeah, because it's sort of like, people call it like a journey, you know, like it's a gross word, but like all those things that I've done, they're just like little steps in, you know, because it's like none of us know anything. Like, none of us know what the fuck we're doing. Like,
yep.
Like that's like but often we try and convince ourselves that we do, or we ignore the things, avoid the things that we don't know, avoid the discomfort and don't go down that path. But I think now, having done this work and seen a psychologist and, you know, spoken to Haim or whatever, it means that I'm much more comfortable now to explore those parts of my life that are uncomfortable and that I feel like I'm not doing very well in, and actually kind of go down that dark path and go like, I know this is my fault, this thing that's happened. I know I've done something wrong here, and I'm going to go down with best intentions and just see what's at the other end, because what's the worst that can happen if I'm open-minded? I forget who said this. I wish I could remember, because it's one of these great things that someone said once, which is, if you're ever in a situation where you're not sure what to do or not sure what to say, always just lead with compassion. And if you lead with compassion, then you can't go wrong. And I think that amongst many other things, sort of things that I often think about, was just like, be open. Like, everyone is just trying to figure it out. Like, the person who you think is a prick, the person who seems like an asshole or is doing you wrong, it's just like, well, what, they've no doubt got their own shame. They've no doubt got their own shit that they're either trying to deal with or haven't been able to deal with. So I think that, and then on top of that, then writing a television show, which I'm trying to do at the moment, it's really interesting in writing characters when you're writing dialogue and you're writing narrative comedy, in my case, thinking about characters from a compassionate place as opposed to just like creating characters that are just very two-dimensional, like going like, oh, he's the prick. she's the bitch, you know, having these very like archetypal characters that aren't real people, because no one's one thing. Everyone's many things, obviously. So I think it's just all that. It's applying all that to my actual life and realizing how shit of a communicator I was as a guy in my 20s and having more compassion and understanding for my girlfriend back then. And she was very emotionally intelligent and I was not, but I didn't know how to be, I didn't know what to do. So it's just, you know, growing, I guess, becoming an adult. Yeah.
You've just spent 3 months in Europe writing, whatever you were writing.
Yeah.
Does what you were talking about with that personal growth through the imperfects and that time, like I think about the time away, generally when you're away from home, it forces you to have this level of introspection about, you know, what you want to do like next. Your experience of, you know, being super vulnerable, your experience with the imperfects, that time away, has it shaped what you want to do next any differently?
A little bit. I think it probably just more shapes how I want to do things,
right,
as opposed to what I want to do.
Yep.
I still want my own TV show.
Yeah.
I still really want to do that. But if I don't get it, I don't. It's fine. Like it's not now. It now doesn't define my worth on this earth.
Yeah.
You know, it's if I don't ever get my own TV show, like that's now okay. Whereas in the past, it would be like my greatest failure to not have my own TV show. And I would feel like I've not lived to my full potential in my eyes. So I think the difference is like how I approach things. Is different, yeah.
Yeah,
so I'd say, yeah.
Cool. What are your? Is it the Ryan show that you're writing?
Yeah. It's just like it's not even happening yet. It's just like we'll pitch it at some point, and it's a very honest. Like it's essentially like an extension of what I do on the Imperfects. It's like all the themes of that, but it packaged as like a comedy show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So hopefully you'll see it one day.
Amazing. How would a couple of guys that you've never met before, but met in Elphington, spoken to for an hour, actually get into that show if it actually got off the ground, do you think?
As far as get on camera?
Yeah.
Oh, there's an audition process, I'm sure.
Hey, Matt, last question. You've been so great with your time and it's such an inspiring story.
It's a pleasure.
When you think about your... I was going to say journey, but what you've been through.
No, journey's fine. It's the right word, yeah.
What you've been through, your advice to those people that are perhaps harbouring a whole bunch of feelings that don't make them feel great about who they are, what would you say? And I reckon there's a lot of people out there that carry a whole lot of stuff around that makes them heavier each day. What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I mean, if it's not obvious by now, I'm not a qualified psychologist and I'm not any sort of – you should not take my – advice is like official clinical guidance, obviously. All I know is my own experience and the things that I've done and like that I've spoken to guests about on the podcast. And I mean, there's so many different things you can do, and I guess it depends on who you are and what the thing is that you're thinking about. But when we're talking about vulnerability, the really, really important thing that everyone always tells me is that like to be vulnerable for the first time, you don't want to just give that to anyone. You don't want to just like sit down with some random person for the first time, and because you want to feel like you're with someone safe that you can trust. That's the most important thing, because it is a big deal, and it is like something you've been, if it's like a shame or something you. A secret you've been harboring about yourself, or something that you haven't felt comfortable talking about, it does help talking about it. But you need to talk about it with either a psychologist or a therapist of some sort. Which I know not everyone can just go see a psychologist; they're expensive and hard to see good ones and stuff. But if there's someone that you trust in your life, I think it's probably a good place to start. One thing often do, like I do a lot of when I'm writing or just trying to work things out, I talk to myself on my on voice memo.
Right.
So in the voice memo app, I'll just like put my earpods in and just walk around, and it looks like I'm on the phone. Just walk through a park, and it looks like I'm talking to someone, but really, maybe it, just to say it out loud for the first time with no one else hearing it. Even just to, you've probably never said it out loud. Mm. Like most people have never actually said it. You've thought about it, maybe written about it, but to say it, to hear yourself saying it, could be. Again, I'm not. I don't really know what I'm talking about, but that would help me. I think. Yeah.
Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
What a great story. Super inspiring. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Me too. Thank you guys so much.
Cheers.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, mate.